Hey y'all, I've got a bit of a lighter episode for you today. Early Appalachian settlers combined their cultural influences to create a wealth of superstitions, guidelines, and folklore, some of it erring on the eerie side. So today I have a smattering of Appalachian folklore to talk about. I'm Candace, and I'll be your guide. In the 1700s, as more Europeans began to make the journey over to the United States, Appalachia became populated primarily with Scotch, Irish, and German settlers who brought with them their African slaves. Each of these groups brought their own cultural influence, which combined with that of the Native Americans whose land they seized. The end result is a menagerie of beliefs that blend to create the soul of Appalachia. These early Appalachians placed a lot of emphasis on luck as a belief. After all, if you're lucky, it could mean something as simple as finding a spare coin, which was very much needed in those times. And if you're unlucky, it could mean something as serious as death or disaster for the early inhabitants. Remnants from their origin countries trickle down into the following superstitions. Visitors should always depart by the same door that they use to enter the home. Leaving through a different door is believed to bring bad luck to both themselves and their host. A horseshoe is sometimes hung over the doorway to a home, upside down, to keep luck from running out. This is the way that I found this documented, but I've also heard to hang it with the opening facing up so that it fills with luck. It is considered bad luck to knit, crochet, make, buy, or otherwise provide clothing as a gift for an infant before the baby is born. Inversely, and interestingly, it's considered good luck for someone to spit on the baby. A baby's hair should never be cut before its first birthday to prevent bad luck from falling upon the child. Don't ever close a knife that you didn't open, as it is said that that will bring you 7 years of bad luck, which honestly seems a little drastic. Then there are the more commonly heard superstitions, such as not walking under a ladder, not opening an umbrella indoors, and that breaking a mirror is 7 years of bad luck. However, if someone is unfortunate enough to break a mirror, there is a mountain cure for that. To break the 7-year bad luck curse, you can take the largest broken piece to the nearest cemetery, and at exactly the stroke of midnight, touch that broken piece to the oldest headstone present. With that, the curse is broken. And finally, on New Year's Day, we eat black-eyed peas and collard greens. The peas are for pennies, and the greens are for dollars, to bring enough money to provide for the family over the new year. I've also heard that some families add ham, and ham is said to be for health. With farming being the most common occupation in much of Appalachia at that time, it is unsurprising that weather is at the root of much of the beliefs and superstitions. The geography of Appalachia has its own unique challenges. For those who lived on hilltops or mountains, mudslides, uprooted trees, and rockfall were a real hazard for homes, farms, and families. For those who live in the valleys, or the holler, the same rockfall and mudslide dangers are accompanied by potentially disastrous flooding. Before weather prediction offered its modern-day level of accuracy, there were a number of ways of predicting weather and conditions, and even a few ways early Appalachians would attempt to control it. A drought was one of the most serious of circumstances possible for Appalachian farmers. They watched closely for signs of upcoming rain, both as a sign of hope in dry times and also as just a warning to get their other outside work done in time. They said that if you see a cat eating grass, or at least 3 cows lying down in the field together, that rain was on its way. If farmers got desperate, they believed you could kill a black snake and hang it from the fence post, belly up, and rain would arrive by the 3rd day. Alternately, it is also said that you can burn black chicken feathers with fern fronds to conjure rain, although I've never heard that one personally. Likewise, predicting particularly harsh seasons was also very important to Appalachian livelihood. It is said that if March comes in like a lion, it leaves like a lamb, and vice versa. The lion in this case being frost, snow, harsh cold, and storms, and the lamb being sunny, warm, and pleasant weather. However, so much of the weather folklore is rooted in predicting the winter weather. Thick ice on the ponds in November is said to be foretelling of a very wet and mucky December. However, thunder during the fall suggests it will be a cold winter. There's the saying, when leaves fall early, fall and winter will be mild. When leaves fall late, winter will be severe and wild, suggesting that a late fall indicates a harsh winter. Appalachians still commonly believe that the number of foggy mornings in August indicates the number of snowy days that will be present in winter. Commonly, throughout the month of August, a bean will be placed into a jar for each foggy morning. Then at the end of the month, they're counted before cooking up the beans with a meal. As I live in southern Appalachia, this number has never even come close to matching for me, but I am curious for those of you more central if you feel this practice is reliable. Often the signs of an approaching rough winter are more subtle and can be found in the environment. It is said that bees build their nests up higher when the upcoming winter will have deeper snow. The animal's fur will be thicker and squirrels' tails bushier. The squirrels and other small critters will be busier, gathering and storing more nuts than usual. The crops can also be an indicator, as corn husks are thicker and hold tightly to the ears, apple skins are thicker, and nuts and berries are plentiful in the fall preceding a nasty winter. Finally, the quote-unquote woolly worm has long been used as a standard of predicting the winter months, and still often is. The woolly worm is a term used for the tiger moth caterpillar, a mixture of reddish-brown with a black band. Old-timers said that the harshness of winter could be predicted by the pattern on the woolly worms making their debut in the fall. If the caterpillar's head is more black than colored, the winter will be at its harshest in the earlier months. The more black than brown on the worm and the wider the stripe is said to indicate how severe and how long the winter season will last. The most immediate weather threat to any Appalachian farming family are storms, and there were a number of ways they went about keeping the storms from damaging their livelihood. It is said that if you go outside in the very beginning of a storm and gather an acorn, if you place that acorn on your windowsill inside, lightning will avoid striking your home. Others believed that a piece of flint stored and heated in the fireplace was the optimal lightning prevention. There were also charms that were carried by people who had to be out and about during the storm. It was believed that geranium petals carried in a purse or pocket prevented lightning strikes. A piece of lightning-struck wood carried by a person was also said to offer the same protection. Interestingly, it was also believed that carrying a white rock and a black rock and striking them together covered a person with an invisible protective barrier that lightning would fail to penetrate. The safest place to be in a storm to prevent lightning strikes was said to be sitting on a feather pillow. The saying was, "Ain't no chicken or duck ever been struck." If, for some bizarre reason, someone wanted to summon lightning, they could do so by burning a piece of formerly lightning-struck wood. Tornadoes weren't too much of a concern, as the area isn't flat enough for one to be on the ground very long, but sometimes one would briefly touch down. To prevent a tornado from hitting the property, you could take a kitchen knife and drive it into the ground, handle side down, so that the blade is facing upward and in the direction of the storm. Supposedly, this cuts the storm in two so it will not harm your home. The same premise applies to using an axe as well, driving it into a stump facing the direction of the storm. For ever-growing Appalachian families, taking care of the youngest members of the family were a top priority. There's a lot of folklore attached to protecting babies, especially in an area where many of them just didn't make it to adulthood. Families tended to be large, and oftentimes children numbered in the double digits, so there was almost always a baby in the home. Without adequate medical access and the albeit limited knowledge we have now of sudden infant death syndrome, early settlers believed SIDS to be the work of the devil. So often babies were given milk with chamomile every night for the first few months to protect their life until the next morning, and it had the added benefit of protecting from the devil. Sometimes charms were created and placed in or near the crib for protection as well. A bundle of honey locust, oak, and walnut, tied by sprigs of willow, was sometimes placed into the crib. Sometimes a nail cross was created and placed in the nursery or attached to the crib. And occasionally, a doll was made and placed into the crib with the infant in attempt to distract any evil forces from placing their work onto the doll instead. More innocuously, if a pregnant woman sees a dead person, it is said that her baby will have a birthmark. There are also physical traits we are born with that are said to indicate our character. A person with a cleft in their chin is said to be of bad character because that mark is placed by the devil's shoe. Also, a person whose second toe is longer than their big toe is said to be somewhat tyrannical and will rule their partner. Finally, it is believed that some people are born with the gift of prophecy. Most often, those who have the gift are said to have gained this by being the seventh son of a seventh son, or the seventh daughter of a seventh daughter. Also, babies born enkal, meaning still in the embryonic sac, are said to have been born with a veil, and they will also have the gift of prophecy. Alongside that fierce protection of infants, remedies for illness and injury were vital to the well-being of the people. If a child had whooping cough, and remember, this is before the era of mass vaccination, food or milk that was stolen from a neighbor and fed to the infant was said to cure the ailment. If a child had a seizure, or as they called it, fits, whether from epilepsy or another cause, they believed you could turn the child's shirt inside out and burn it to cure the fits. A sore throat could be cured by wearing wool stockings and then at bedtime, turning them inside out and putting them back on and wear that way to sleep to cure the inflamed throat. Drinking liquids from a cobalt blue glass is said to cure a toothache. If a child has thrush, otherwise known as a yeast infection on the tongue, they suggest you take that child to a man who has never seen his own father before. Have the man blow into the child's face 3 times a day for 3 days to cure the thrush. To cure a headache, they said you could apply brown paper soaked in vinegar to the forehead. Also, a buckeye worn in a woman's bra could ward off rheumatism. And finally, a creepier one. If a person has a goiter on their neck, they should go to a place where a person has recently died and rub the dead person's hand across their throat to cure the goiter. Now, obviously, this random smattering of Appalachian health folklore is not rooted in any science because much of it wasn't available at that time. And had it been, it wouldn't have been accessible. But it is interesting to see how things used to be done. Belief in the devil, curses, and witchcraft was prevalent throughout Appalachia, and the locals devised their ways to deal with these potential threats. To protect yourself from potential curses or the evil eye, you could bundle a lock of your own hair, a stick from your yard, and one of your own fingernail clippings together. Tie that with a red string or a strip of red flannel. The red is important since it symbolizes the lifeblood. As long as you carry that bundle with you, you're supposedly immune to curses. However, it warns that if you were to lose this talisman, these items could be used to send witchcraft your way. Dried corn cobs were sometimes hung on porches to keep evil at bay, but most often you'd see them hung in the barn to keep the wee folk from stealing or killing the livestock. The wee folk is the name for leprechauns in legends brought over from, of course, Ireland. If those dried corn cobs in the barn were wrapped in pig fur and red cloth, this was also said to protect from any attempts of witchcraft toward the animals. The folklore of Appalachia is largely rooted in the hazards of living in the area at that time. High rates of infant and maternal mortality and poor outcomes from illness and disease due to numerous factors, not limited to the remote area, very limited income, poor preventive care, and harsh living conditions caused the mortality rates in Appalachia to be higher than the national average. Life expectancy in Appalachia at that time was roughly 60 years old at best. And sadly, the life expectancy in Appalachia is still lower than the national average for many of those same reasons. The occupations held were primarily blue-collar and largely dangerous. Most early Appalachians were farmers, coal miners, railway workers, loggers, and mill workers. These industries, particularly at that time, had fairly high mortality rates overall. All of these things being considered, illness and death are the predominant subjects of signs and omens throughout early Appalachia. When workers went off to dangerous jobs, they often carried a charm with them. Things from iron nails, a rabbit's foot, a dried leather bean, and other small, lucky items were often carried with them to ward off death and injury. There were several signs that were considered omens of death at the time. One of the common themes seems to be animals making their sounds at times when it was unusual. A dog howling at night was considered to be a portent of death, as well as a cow mooing at night or an owl hooting during the day. Some believed that seeing an owl out during the daytime at all was a symbol of an impending death. Notably, I've only seen an owl once during the daytime, and yes, death did soon follow. However, thankfully, another common belief that a bird flying into the window pane was an omen hasn't held true, since that is not so uncommon here. Doing laundry on New Year's Day is said to be very ill-advised, as it could cause a death in the family by quote-unquote washing the family away. However, after all those ill omens, it's comforting to know that early Appalachians believed if you see a red cardinal, it's a departed loved one coming back to say hello. With all the talk of death and dying, it's the perfect time to delve into one of the creepier parts of Appalachian folklore, haints. The term haint is derived from the European word hanter, which means to stalk or inhabit. From there, the term gained traction within the African slave community of Appalachia and was first recorded in use in 1843. Haint is used as a general term for ghosts or spirits, but not typically the granny in the rocking chair at a haunted house type of spirit. Haints were generally regarded as restless and mischievous, sometimes who were lost between worlds without being able to find their way, and sometimes just a little bit more malevolent. Preventing haints was an integral part of Appalachian life in big and small ways. If you've ever passed by a home and spotted a tree outside with bottles hanging from it, this was a common way of creating, essentially, a haint trap. Several colorful bottles are either threaded onto the branches of a tree outside the home or hung from them with wire. It is said that the bottles would trap roaming haints at nighttime until the sunlight of the day would destroy them. Bottle trees as a line of defense originated in Africa, and the tradition followed with the slaves of Appalachia before becoming more widespread. Distracting haints with counting tricks was a common tactic, as it was generally believed that a haint would be distracted with counting items upon attempting to enter a home until the sun came up, which would dispatch them. Sometimes a wall in the entryway of the home was lined in newspaper in attempt to have the haints count every single word. Similar ideas were behind using items such as a broom or a bag of rice. Fortunately, it is said that haints lose count very often and must start over from the beginning, so they don't even need that many items to count. In southern Appalachia, oftentimes after death, the mirrors in the home were covered to prevent a person's soul from becoming trapped in the mirror, creating a haint. It was also important to open the windows so that the spirit could depart easily. Make sure to resist the urge to rock an empty rocking chair, as this could invite haints into your home to occupy it. Also, make sure to keep a can of oil nearby to oil any squeaky doors or windows, as the squeaking is said to be an invitation for haints to come inside. When outside the home, there are also several methods of haint prevention at play. Resist the urge to whistle at night, particularly when outside, as this could draw haints and the supernatural to you. Plant rue outside the home and hang basil over doors and windows. This discourages haints from visiting you or entering your home. When passing a cemetery, many believe you should wear a hat to keep the haints from hopping on your back to catch a ride. Others say you should hold your breath the entire time you're passing so that you don't breathe them in. If you hang a mirror by your front door, it is said that haints, or the devil, either one, are so vain that they'll be distracted by their own reflection long enough to forget to enter until sunrise. In this same haints or the devil mindset, you always leave one apple hanging on your apple tree to keep the devil away. If you believe there are haints already in the home, a cleansing is recommended. Burn sage or incense and mop the floors with pine and camphor. Place salt across the doors and windows, as well as in the corners of the home. Finally, we can't talk haints without talking about haint blue. I previously referenced the African slaves who brought about many Appalachian traditions. When those slaves were initially captured while in Africa, they were placed into prison cells along the African coastline. While there, they encountered Africans from other countries and cultures other than their own. And this intermingling of cultures and dialects formed the basis of the Gullah Geechee people. The Gullah Geechee are descendants of those captured slaves and were initially brought to the Charleston, South Carolina area in the 1500s. The Gullah tradition states that spirits cannot cross water, so an attempt to confuse and stop haints from entering their homes, the tradition of haint blue was born. Initially a distinct blue-green turquoise hue, the Gullah people, and later Appalachians, painted the ceilings of their covered porches with the color, and sometimes also used it on the windowsills, shutters, and doors. The color haint blue is still so commonly used in the South, from the Charleston area over west to Louisiana, that Sherwin-Williams discusses it on their website when discussing options for porch paint colors. Nowadays, the tradition has been watered down a little bit, and the distinctive blue-green color is sometimes replaced with a sky blue. The tradition that I was taught is that blue ceilings on the porch deters flies. At one point in history, it was true, as blue paint used to be made with lye, which is an insect repellent. But while inaccurate in modern day, the origins of the use of blue remained with keeping the haints at bay. In addition to haint blue, occasionally random blue panes of glass were placed into the home's windows with the same purpose. Okay, now that we've covered heaps of Appalachian signs, omens, and superstitions, let's wrap things up with an Appalachian folktale from way back when, and that is the story of Taily Po. The story begins with Old Man Fletcher, who's cooking a small handful of beans over the fire in his home. He was very hungry and very poor and longing for anything more substantial than beans when a black paw scratched through his floorboards. A long weasel-type creature came up through the floor, long and lean with a thick, meaty tail. The creature hissed at the old man and bared its teeth at him. But as it fled back through the hole in the floor, Old Man Fletcher responded by just hacking off the critter's tail with his hatchet and just tossing it into his pot of beans, you know, like you do. However, just a few minutes later, The creature was back and seeking vengeance. It screeched, "Taillipo! Taillipo! Where is my Taillipo?" The creature continued to torment the old man for a while before eventually burning down his home while he was inside of it. This story is believed to be a moral tale, told to encourage kids not to mistreat animals or to take things that aren't theirs. All right, y'all, that's all for today's Appalachian folklore episode. Now let's talk about it. So these are really fun because I heard a lot of these in some variety growing up. We always ate black-eyed peas and collards on New Year's Day. I was instructed as a child to not try to be helpful and close a knife for someone else. The ceilings of my porches are painted sky blue, and I was, I'll say, lovingly forced into not cutting my child's hair before he turned one. Others I've never heard before, like a cleft chin being a sign of bad character. That one honestly makes me sad to think that people would make an assumption that a genetic trait makes someone a bad person. The cures for illness are obviously very concerning. None of that is rooted in medicine. If you haven't caught in earlier episodes, I used to be a nurse and this stuff bothers me, but it's entirely possible that the herbal remedies used at that time are just not referenced with folklore because many of them actually did have helpful, beneficial attributes. So this might just be the line where folklore is separated from primitive medicine or from herbalism. I have to imagine that most of the things they believed to be omens of death were things that just coincidentally happened prior to the death of someone they loved. And with the way that word traveled through friends and neighbors, through storytelling specifically, really lends itself strongly to being retold as truth in that way. A side note, I learned while researching this how bottle trees are a haint trap. I thought they were just quirky outdoor decor all this time, and it honestly makes them cooler. But it can't be understated how haint blue is just the most prevalent haint prevention that still exists to this day. And by that, obviously, I mean that color being still used. I know this episode is a little different from usual, but folklore has a huge bearing on the stories that are passed from generation to generation, which could directly reflect in some paranormal stories. And generally speaking, folklore is a bedrock of culture. It influences art, stories, and daily life still. In closing, I'll leave you with a tidbit of folklore that I always heard that didn't really fit anywhere else in the episode. I was always told, if the sun shines while it's raining, the devil is beating his wife. As always, I want to know what you think. Have you heard many of these? What little bits of superstition were you told over the years? Reach out to me on social media under Obscure Appalachia. Feel free to send me any thoughts, episode suggestions, or your own paranormal experiences at obscureappalachia@gmail.com. I love hearing from y'all. If you're loving the podcast and would like to support me and get bonus content, visit patreon.com/obscureappalachia. As always, thank you for listening. Until next time.